Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Bidder Information webcast. This is the webcast related to the Summer 2023 Index REC RFP. This is for the procurement of RECs from utility scale wind, utility scale solar, as well as brownfield site photovoltaic projects. Joining with me today and presenting is Mr. Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA Economic Consulting, the procurement administrator on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency for this RFP. A few housekeeping items before we get started. So on this cover slide, you see a couple of logos at the bottom of this slide. This is the procurement of RECs for the IPA's portfolio of these utilities that you'll find here. First, you have Ameren Illinois Company, or AIC for short, Commonwealth Edison Company, or ComEd, as well as Mid-American Energy Company, or MEC, or Mid-American for short. On this slide, number two, for today's presentation, the presentation itself, as well as the audio recording will be posted to the RFP website, and you will find the URL for the procurement website at the bottom of this slide too, which is ipa-energyrfp.com. You can ask your questions at any point in time during this presentation. If anything is unclear, simply locate the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. A pop-up should appear where you can enter your question and submit them to the presenters. We'll try to answer your questions along the way, but we have a dedicated time at the end of this presentation portion. So for this procurement, this is pursuant to the Illinois Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, or CEJA, and what we more formally call the Public Act 1020662. This is also pursuant to the IPA's Renewable Resources Long-Term Plan Update that is found in docket number 22-0231. So the governing documents for this procurement will include the Public Act, the FALC plan as approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission, as well as the final RFP rules and the final contract that have been posted on Friday, April 28. You'll find all of these documents on our procurement website. The link is provided at the bottom of this slide. And the disclaimer is this, that USD bidders will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these written documents. And any statements that we make on this call that describe or refer to the governing documents that will include the RFP and the contract, they're all summaries only, and they're qualified in their entirety by our reference to these documents. On this slide four, here is a screenshot of the procurement website. The URL you can find at the top of this slide. Once you're there, you should see the IPA's logo at the top. If you scroll to the left navigation bar will list some of the ongoing procurements. And this particular RFP is known as the Index Wind, Solar, and Brownfield RFP. You can click on that link. A couple of sub-links should appear. And if you click on where it says Final Materials, you'll find the final materials as posted for this RFP on Friday, April 28th. And on slide five, in terms of the agenda for today, the presentation itself is about 70 slides long, and we have scheduled about 90 minutes to go through the material and then leave some time at the end for questions. In terms of the agenda for today, we will cover the background and the context for this RFP, and then we will provide you a very high level overview of the entire RFP and what you can expect in terms of the requirements. And then we will walk you through the terms of the transactions as provided in the supplier contract, and spend the latter part of the presentation on the practical aspects of your participation. We will go through the timeline and the specific requirements, how you will submit the materials to us, and what we're looking for. So with that, I will turn the time now to Mr. Anthony Starr. Mr. Starr?
Great, thank you. And thank you everybody for joining today. I'm gonna spend a few minutes talking about some of the regulatory background and a couple of key sort of updates from the IPA that may be relevant for the participants today, those of you participating in the index track procurement. Ben touched on this already a little bit, just the regulatory context for where we are is that the index direct procurement model was adopted through Public Act 102-0662, better known as the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. This was the law enacted in September of 2021 that updated the Illinois Renewable Portfolio Standard, among other things. And it introduced the concept of index directs rather than having procurements to incent the development of utility scale solar, wind, and brownfield site projects through fixed direct prices. So we've had a big shift in how we approach at the IPA, what we're doing to encourage the development of those sorts of projects through the Climate Equitable Jobs Act. We put a lot of that into practice through our long-term renewable resources procurement plan, which was released in the summer of 2022, the final version of it. And the procurement that we're discussing today flows out of that plan and the provisions put into place through that plan in terms of our interpretation of how to implement the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. This procurement and a subsequent one in the fall will flow from that plan. I also want to note that we will be updating the procurement plan this summer, putting out a draft comment that will be approved next year, and that would guide future procurements that will take place in calendar years 2024 and 2025. Next slide, please. A key concern to stakeholders has been the Renewable Portfolio Standard budget and the availability of funds under different scenarios going forward. So in order to try to look at that a little bit more, the IPA released a budget update last month with some updated numbers where we brought in the results of our previous index direct procurements into the model. Previously, we had used placeholder proxies for the fixed direct price procurements that we had conducted prior to the Climate Equitable Jobs Act. We also included in that budget update 10 different scenarios to show how changes and assumptions that go into the budget would change the availability of funds in the future for the Renewable Portfolio Standard. In some cases, significantly increasing the funding available. In other cases, creating a potential budget shortfall. So I think that's a very useful thing for stakeholders to think about in terms of understanding, you know, what are the risks and uncertainties around the RPS budget. It may well be that statutory changes will be needed to address these issues, but for the time being, this is sort of the scenarios that we have available to think about what the budget would look like. The full budget model is available for download, so you can go in and if you want to make different assumptions about things like what future energy prices would be or future strike prices from procurements, you can make adjustments as well, or you can look at the models that we've presented in the update to sort of give yourself a flavor of what those might look like. So hopefully that will be a tool for participants and other interested parties in sort of assessing sort of the risks and uncertainty that may be there around the RPS budget. We hope that it will provide some certainty and also provide sort of an ongoing way to discuss what we can do to improve both our procurements and potentially have statutory changes going forward. Next slide, please. A few new things that are coming out from the IPA, and there'll be more discussion of this later on in the presentation, is that one of the key components of this procurement are the minimum equity standards, which are to help sort of build a more diverse and equitable workforce developing clean energy projects in Illinois. So a tool that we released in January, so this will be the first time it's available since the last procurement we did last year, is our Energy Workforce Equity Portal. This is a place where clean energy companies can post jobs looking for what are known as equity eligible persons, as well as for equity eligible persons to register and be identified and help them seek jobs or use that as a tool for their employer to sort of validate that they would count towards our equity standards. So that's a tool we've just launched. We'll be continuing to refine it. I know there's been a lot of interest in that going forward. There's some a lot of material on that website about how that works. We also more generally have now on the IPA's website a minimum equity standard page where we're trying, where we're providing all the information around the minimum equity standards that cut across both these index direct procurements as well as our adjustable block program. We have various training resources there as well as information about the equity standard plans that will need to be submitted by selected bidders. There'll be more information discussed later on in the presentation, but we're now really housing that on the IPA website to be tools and resources available for participants. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Ben.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Starr. So on this slide and this section generally, I'm just going to provide a very high level overview of the RFP itself. We will flesh out the details in a later portion of this presentation. So first thing to note, the bid date. The bid date is on June 23rd. And we have here these targets. These numbers represent the number of racks that we are looking to procure across all the projects that are selected through this RFP, and these racks are to be delivered annually when the projects come online. We have a target of 1.75 million RECs annually from utility scale wind projects, 1 million RECs annually from utility scale solar projects, and 65,000 RECs annually from brownfield site photovoltaic projects. The contract will feature an index REC structure where payment will flow either from buyer to seller or seller to buyer. The RECs must be from these winning projects that are proposed in the RFP and selected by us. And because there are three utility counterparties, there'll be an allocation of your RECs, and you must be willing to sign three contracts for each winning project. In your bid, you will indicate three things, principally: a strike price on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. This strike price is not what you'll be paid, but the strike price will represent what we will use to compare against the index price, and the difference at each hour will be used to calculate the price for payment. There will be a quantity that you will name. In fact, there'll be two quantities that you will name as part of your bid. There will be the full quantity. Is this just an annual number of RECs that you're committing to under the contracts? And then there is also a minimum quantity that we'll be asking you to provide as a number of RECs of what happens if we can accept not all of the RECs from your project, but a portion of your RECs. This is again analogous to the full quantity on an annual delivery basis. This is used in a case when we have a target that we need to fill, but taking another project, what we call the marginal project, would cause the target to be exceeded. So at that point, we may award the seller sort of a partial award, something less than the full quantity, but we will never award any amount of RECs that is less than the minimum quantity that you have indicated. So the other thing is that the last component of the bid here is really for you to indicate the index hub. This can either be the PJM NIHUB, the Northern Illinois hub, or the MISO Illinois hub as the index price trading hub that will be used to calculate the REC price. So over on this slide, slide four, we have a couple of real definitions that come out from CESIA. So to be considered a utility scale wind or solar project, the size of the project must be greater than 5 megawatts on an AC rating basis. The projects must be either located in Illinois or a state adjacent to Illinois, or a project that has energy transmitted through HVDC lines into Illinois. So in general, if your project is not in Illinois, do reach out to us as soon as possible. That might be the easiest thing to do so that we can direct you and provide you more information related to the projects that are located outside of Illinois for participation. In general, for projects that are in an adjacent state, your project will need to be pre-vetted by the Illinois Power Agency. This will ensure that it meets the public interest criteria. This is meant to give you some confidence when you submit your project into the procurement process that it will meet the criteria based on the information that has been pre-vetted by the agency. You will be required in the RFP to inform us of the project location. The project site itself will be entered into the contract, and the general rule is that 50% of the project must be located on the site that you have identified at this RFP stage. Your project must be new under Illinois law, and that means that the date of first operation must be after June 1st, 2017. Your project will also be subject to a number of labor requirements that I will go through in later part of this presentation. The project, if it's a solar project, utility scale solar project here, it must be installed by qualified persons as the term is defined in the contract as well as in the law. For this upcoming RFP, we have a new requirement. A new provision, actually, not required for all projects. But the concept that we're bringing in here is the concept of a energy transition community grant area, or what we call the ETCG area. There are currently 22 ETCG areas that have been identified by the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, the DCEO. If your project is proposed on a site that is in a ETCG area, you will qualify for a reduced strike price adjustment. This is for purposes of the bid evaluation only. It doesn't affect how you're getting paid. It just makes your project more competitive in the bid ranking. And we'll provide more information on this later on as well. On this slide 13, this is a slide on brownfield site photovoltaic projects. Most of the requirements you see here are identical to what you find for utility scale solar projects. The only difference that I'll highlight here on this slide is that there's really no size requirement for these brownfield site photovoltaic projects. It can be smaller than 5 megawatts, for example. But it does need to be located in Illinois, and the site itself, the project site itself, must be entirely contained within the brownfield site that you identify. And as you can find here on the third bullet on this slide 13, you'll be asked to provide us documentation that demonstrates the site itself is indeed a brownfield site as defined in the law. On this slide 14, this talks about what we are buying. And maybe I'll start with what we're not buying. So we're not buying your project. We're not buying your energy that comes out from your project or your capacity. We're buying the RECs from your project. The RECs must be RECs from the project selected through this RFP. That means that replacement RECs are not eligible. They must be from the project. And the RECs must include all environmental attributes and transferred via a standing order. You'll be required to register with GATS or MRATS, and it must be transferred via the standing order in a retired state to us. The RECs must allow buyer to comply with the Illinois RPS. This is going to be a 20-year REC delivery contract, and we will accept RECs starting from the vintage month when the electricity is actually generated for the vintage month of August of this year. The deadline itself for the first REC delivery is currently set at May 31st, 2027. This is basically the default deadline for when we expect to see the first REC being delivered under the contracts. If you need more time, you can get an extension for this initial deadline. There's a very generous extension policy under the contracts that allows for an initial extension, for example, for 2 years without questions, but posting of additional collateral, and then further extensions for good cause that can be requested. There will be a two-part application process or proposal process. Part one, I will start with the timeline. The part one window runs from May 3rd through May 18 at noon. This is a noon central prevailing time deadline. And then for part two, the time and the window starts June 2nd and runs through June 15 at noon. The main thing to understand here about the entire process is that this is done online. We will never ask you for a paper copy of any document. But what we do ask is if there are documents, they will be scanned, sometimes need to be signed, scanned, and then uploaded through the application website. The only thing on part one that will require you to do something outside of the part one online form is the payment of your bid participation fee. This is a fee of $500 and paid directly to the Illinois Power Agency. Part one is for you to respond to the qualification requirements of our RFP. You'll have to provide contact information as well as identify for us who the bidder is, who the seller is, and some information about your project. Part two works similarly to like part one. It's done online. The only thing that is outside of the online form is the payment of your bid assurance collateral, and that goes directly to each of the utilities. Part two is for you to provide us additional information and certification right before we receive your bids. In terms of bid evaluation, once we have qualified you pursuant to a successful part one and registered you with for the RFP for your part two, then there will be a time where we will receive your bids. Bid date is on June 23rd. There will be a bid window in that morning. Once the bids are received, bids will be evaluated on a price-only basis, and we are not engaging in any post-bid negotiation under this process. So again, bids will be evaluated on a price-only basis, and what we'll be looking at is your strike price. We'll be evaluating the bids for each category separately. This means that wind projects will not be evaluated with the solar projects, and brownfield projects are evaluated separately, separate from utility scale solar projects. We have a benchmark. The benchmark is developed in consultation with the procurement monitor and approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. This is a confidential benchmark, and bids that do not exceed the benchmark will be considered, and only those that do not exceed the benchmark will be considered. One other thing, well, maybe two other things to highlight here on this slide is that there is a place we have in place where bids may be subject to some price adjustments so that the bids itself, your strike price, will become more competitive for purposes of bid ranking. So this comes about where either you propose to commit to an equity standard above the minimum 10% minimum equity standard, or if you are proposing for your utility scale wind or solar projects to be cited in one of the ETCG areas. This only applies to utility scale projects, not for brownfield site projects. And you can find an appendix 16 of the rules that list out for you the list of qualifying ETCG areas. So that's the first thing to note for you. These two items are really on an optional basis. You do not need to indicate a commitment greater than 10% of the MES, and you do not need to have a project cited in an ETCG area. But if you do, you may be receiving a price reduction so that your bids will be more competitive in the bid ranking. The second new item that we have brought in is provisions for a soft cap. So what is new in this summer 2023 solicitation is that we have provisions to implement the REC targets that I indicated earlier, more as soft caps. So for each category, this will come into play where we are considering marginal projects. Again, the highest price project that has yet to be selected, but the selection which would cause the targets to be exceeded for that category. So in that case, under certain conditions, we may allow for the procurement or the selection of that marginal project. And we have more information about this in Appendix 15 of the RFP rules. On this slide 17, I'll talk about the rules, the fees rather, associated with your participation. So the first type of fee that is associated with your participation is the bid participation fee. The requirement is $500. It is required from all bidders that participate in the IPA's procurement events in 2023. So if you have already paid for this in a prior event in 23, you don't need to pay for it again. And this is tied not to the projects, but to the bidder. So if you are proposing multiple projects, you pay this fee only once. So this is not tied individually to each project. The fee is $500, it's due to the IPA. It is due by noon on the part one date. We can provide you more information on how you pay this fee if you email us to the email address illinois-rfp@nira.com. You may have received some of the emails from that address from us. You can use that email address to request that information. The email address is also provided at the end of this presentation on the last slide as well, so that you can have that as a reference. The second type of fee is what we call the supplier fee. It is not paid by any bidder or all bidders. It is paid only by winning bidders, meaning that if you have a project that is selected as a winning project, that is who we are after, only the winning bidders. And this amount is provided here for you on a per rec basis of your annual quantity and as an estimate only, estimated at 40 cents per rec of your annual quantity. The final and amount that will be provided to you will be finalized and confirmed no later than June 21st, which is 2 business days prior to the bid day. Once again, this is only for winning projects. If you do not win, you do not pay the supplier fee. This is due to us within 7 days of the ICC approval of the bid results, and it will be paid to the IPA. Now we'll take a deep dive into some of the key contract elements. This was posted, the final documents were posted on April 28. You will not just find the posted contract, but a couple of red lines that will facilitate your review if you have been following us for a while through the prior solicitations. The red line could be helpful. On this slide here, I'm just highlighting for you that a few things. One is that the contract main body itself will contain the right on obligations of both buyer and seller, and the project and transaction specific information will be entered into the product order. So that will contain the annual quantity, the strike price, and the index hub, for example, that you have indicated in your bids. I will highlight a couple of sections for your convenience. These are probably the key items that you'll be interested in, and more or less the meat and potatoes of the key provisions. So you have the product and facility requirements in Article 2, delivery obligations in Article 4, payment and invoicing requirements in Article 5, reporting requirements in Article 6, and the collateral requirements in Article 7. We have also a couple of examples appended to the end of the contract. So the basics of the contract is set up here on slide 20. The contract is between seller, who has the right to convey the title and transfer the RECs to buyer. The buyer in this case is again one of the three utilities, Ameren Illinois, ComEd, or Mid-American Energy Company. So if you win for one project, that one project will be subject to three agreements that you have to sign. And the recs for each of the winning projects will be allocated to these three companies. Once the contract is signed and the recs allocated, then the contract will be administered separately for each of the companies. On this slide 21, here we basically translate for you how bid information is translated to contract information. Again, in your bids, you will name a quantity as strike price and index hub. The quantity that is awarded is then allocated to each of the companies. This is now known as the annual quantity in each of the contract. The strike price and the index hub will be translated directly into the contract as is, and the maximum contract quantity that can be paid out under the contract is going to be just 20 years times the annual quantity in that contract. So on this slide 22, we just talked a little bit here on the standing order and the registration with the tracking system. So you must register your project once it comes online with PGM, EIS, GATS, or MRADS. The standing order must be established. The standing order will be based on a few things and principally will reflect the recs committed to each of the companies. Two things I'll highlight here for you. First, there's no prohibition on the size changes under the contract. If you propose a project that is sized, for example, at 50 megawatts, and you want to build something even larger than that, you can do so. There's no prohibition or restrictions in size changes. But just take note that there are definitions in the law, for example, utility size projects must be above 5 megawatts, and you cannot contradict that. The second item is that we are no longer collecting the RFP project percentage at the RFP stage. You simply need to determine what the committed percentage is. This allows you to find another off-taker for the portion of your project and to commit a portion to the contract. And you just need to figure out what that project committed percentage is under the contract and provide that information to the buyer counterparty prior to the establishment of the standing order. So this actually helps you to figure things out later on in the process. There's nothing that you need to tell us in advance of when your project is energized and when you're ready to set up your standing order. The only thing to note is once the standing order is set under the contract, it cannot change for the rest of the delivery term. You can find out more information on the exact calculation of the standing order in section 2 of the contract. So the other thing to note here has to do with the vintage requirements. The earliest vintage month is August 2023. That's the earliest possible vintage month that we will accept. So vintage is, again, tied to when the electricity is generated for your project that gave rise to those recs. We will not consider anything with a vintage earlier than August of 2023. The project itself can come online at any time after June 1st of 2017, all the way through the date of first operation that must occur before May 31st of 2027. So that's sort of the general timeline, and to give you a sense of how we are looking at the delivery and online requirements. In terms of the standing order, the request must be within 30 days of the project's date of first operation. In terms of the collateral requirements, we're looking for $4 times the annual quantity for wind projects and $10 times the annual quantity for solar projects. And both solar and wind projects are subject to a minimum requirement of $20,000. So just take note, this is a reduction from prior rounds. So now the minimum quantity under each contract is simply $20,000. These requirements are collateral requirements specific to a contract with a utility counterparty. So each contract will have an annual quantity, and you need to multiply the annual quantity allocated to the utility times these numbers that I provided to you here. If your project requires an extension, meaning that it will come online on a delayed basis for whatever reason, there is an automatic extension. No reasons required to be provided. And that could push the first REC delivery deadline out to May 31st, 2029. You just need to post additional collateral. And the additional collateral is basically twice the existing collateral requirement. Once the project comes online, you get to reduce that back to the original amount. We do provide an unsecured line of credit if you're relying on a guarantor or if you're a creditworthy entity. You must, and what we mean by creditworthy, what we mean there is you must have at least an investment grade rating of BBB- from S&P or Fitch, or Baa3 or above from Moody's. And the unsecured credit that will be granted is currently at $2.5 million to cover any exposure. If you're relying on a guarantor, you will need a parental guarantee acceptable to the utilities to be granted this unsecured credit. Any exposure that is beyond the unsecured credit that is granted, if any is granted to you, then it must be met with either cash or a letter of credit. One thing to note for bidders that are joining us anew is, and that have been following us in the prior solicitations, is that cash posted as bid assurance collateral may now be used to be considered as post-bid collateral under the contract. It's an option that you may request in this process. So now we'll move on to slide 25, talking about the delivery obligations. The initial delivery, again, is for your first REC to be delivered under the contract by May 31st, 2027. You can extend this by posting additional collateral. It pushes this out by 2 years. And any extension after that could be requested by the IPA for good cause. It must be demonstrated by you, it must be requested by you. It's on a case-by-case basis. It cannot be something that is attributable to you. So the extension is an option, and you can do that by requesting that of the IPA. If the deadline for the first REC is extended beyond May 31st, 2030, you have the right as the seller to request for the contract to be terminated and your collateral to be returned to you. If the deadline is extended beyond May 31st, 2034, and it still couldn't get online for reasons out of your control, then the contract itself will be terminated and the collateral will be returned back to you. And on this slide, slide 26, is a slide that talks about the time elements of the contract. So under the index REC contract, here you will see a couple of things. So payment could be tied to the vintage of your RECs. Both payment and pricing really will be tied to the vintage of your RECs. And I will kind of cover two things here. First is the delivery term and then the acceptable vintage period. Maybe I'll cover the vintage period first. So the vintage period is basically tied to the electricity that is generated from the project that give rise to these RECs that you're delivering. The earliest vintage month cannot be earlier than August of 2023. The vintage itself, again, is on a month-by-month basis, and the earliest could be later, but cannot be earlier than the August 2023 date that I provided to you. In general, the project, once it becomes operational, once it comes online, it will basically set for us the earliest vintage month. The latest vintage month will be 241 months after that first vintage month. This gives you a full 20 years and an extra start month in case your project is not energized on the first of the month for a full rack delivery vintage to be considered. The delivery term more or less tracks closely to the vintage period. And the delivery term starts on the first day when the racks are issued by GETS and MRETS. This starts the clock for all of the delivery term under the three utility contracts for your project. And it will end on the last day of the third month after the acceptable vintage period. So this is kind of in recognition of the fact that there is a lag time for when racks are issued and the time when the racks are based on the electric generation. So we allow for at least three more months for you to turn over the racks through the standing order. So in terms of the delivery obligation, the annual quantity that you set in your bids, that gets translated into some sort of a smaller number in your annual quantity in the contract, given that there are three contracts that this is allocated under. The annual quantity in the contracts for the solar projects will be subject to a degradation, and that will become the delivery requirement for each of the 20-year delivery years for delivery of your racks. This will be provided in the product order when you execute the contract. And the requirement is basically this. If you fail to meet the delivery year requirement for three or more times, and the amount of the shortfall cumulatively is greater than or equal to the annual quantity, then your contract is terminated and the collateral requirement is forfeited. This is an event of default. So we really want you to be able to at least meet the delivery requirements under your contract. But you don't need to meet it every year. You could fail to meet it for some of the years, but it cannot be to the extent where the cumulative amount of your shortfall exceeds the annual quantity or 1 year's worth of racks. The other thing that we will note is that we will only count shortfall years after the full delivery year has occurred, meaning that the stub year doesn't count and the first full 12-month delivery year doesn't count. So potentially you have time all the way through the second full delivery year for these shortfalls to start to accrue. Again, the delivery requirement is based on the rack vintage. That's how we account for the racks, meaning that we're looking at racks that are having a vintage of June through May of a year. And that is also what we will base for the maximum rack quantity that can be accounted for payment in a delivery year. On slide 28, we do allow you some flexibility. So before I talk about the flexibility, I'll tell you what we are not as a standard in the contract, not going to count for payments. First, ineligible racks, defined to be racks that are outside of the acceptable vintage period. This cannot be eligible for payment. The second are racks that are transferred, that are not transferred rather, due to the project committed percentage. These are racks that you have committed to other off-takers and have been informed to the buyer counterparty right before you establish the standing order. So those racks you get to keep. They have not been transferred. They are not eligible for payment. And the third type of racks that are not eligible for payment are what we call excess racks, racks that are in the delivery period, in the acceptable vintage period, generated, but they are generated in excess of the delivery year requirement. This is again based on the vintage of the racks. So those racks that are in excess of the delivery requirement cannot be paid to you. That hits the maximum annual payment allowable, they are returned back to you. And under the contract, we have a provision for seller to provide and transfer back these racks to you if you notify buyer they are transferred based on the contract as ineligible for payment. You can find this in section 2.3F subpara 6 of the REC contract. The new provision that we are providing now is that in order to mitigate the shortfall amounts that are incurred in any prior year, you could make a manual transfer to the buyer counterparty. This could be excess RECs, as we define here, or RECs that are outside of the project committed percentage, but they must be within the acceptable vintage period. And you can use those RECs and deliver them on a manual basis to buyer and to inform buyer these are RECs to mitigate or to account in lieu of the shortfall amounts. In terms of payment and invoicing, this is again on an index REC basis. And so the payment could flow from buyer to seller or from seller to buyer. RECs are accounted for on a monthly basis. The two key components, two definitions in the contract, the REC monthly price hourly component and the REC monthly price, the definitions in Article 1 of the contract. So at each hour, what we're looking at is first the difference between the index price and the strike price. And the hourly component is basically the difference between the index price and the strike price multiplied by the amount of generation, megawatt hours, by the project during that hour. And then you aggregate that across all hours in that month and divide that by the megawatt hour of actual generation of the project for that month, that will give you the weighted average REC monthly price. So that price is what will determine who pays who. If the price is positive, then seller pays buyer. And if the price is negative, then buyer will pay seller. That only accounts for the price. The invoice amount has two components. There's a price component and then there is a volume component. So you need to take the monthly price as calculated by the IPA based on this definition that we have shown you here, multiply that by the RECs that are actually delivered for that vintage, and that will become the invoice amount. So to flesh things out a little bit further, this slide 31 here basically illustrates for you that there is a lag between vintage one versus when the RECs are actually delivered to the buyer's GETS and MREDS account and when the invoices are settled. So working through an example here, if electricity from your project starts in August of 2023, within the fifth business day of September, this puts it on September 8th, you as the seller must provide the hourly generation for the whole month of August for the entirety of the project. And you need to provide this generation megawatt hour data to the IPA and buyer. And based on this information, the IPA will then calculate and issue the calculation notice, the price calculation notice to both buyer and seller by the 20th day of September. This brings us to September 20th. That notice from the IPA will tell you what the monthly REC price is. We expect, because of the lag time between generation of electricity and REC issuance by GETS and MREDS, that RECs will be issued by the tracking registry sometime on the last business day or the last day of September. So take note, REC issuance and delivery occurs after the REC price calculation notice is issued by the IPA. So with both pieces of information, the price that you will receive on September 20th and the actual RECs that gets transferred on September 30th, you will then issue to buyer your invoice by October the 10th. And then the RECs that are accounted for by buyer will be paid based on your invoice by the last day of October. So this sets up the monthly payment cycle for you. On slide 32, we have an example of how the price is determined and calculated and what your invoice amount is. So again, this will occur on a monthly basis. And on this slide here, when the price is negative, here as determined by the IPA, this will occur in September, then we will have a notice issued by the IPA to buyer and seller. RECs you will deliver to buyer's account. Once they are accounted for, you will then prepare an invoice, which is just taking the monthly price times the number of RECs delivered to get the invoice amount that will be paid. You can find the requirements more fleshed out in section 5.1 of the REC contract. So there are a couple of labor requirements tied to the contract. So first, there is the prevailing wage requirements. This is applicable to all projects throughout the contract term. As long as construction activities occurs during the period of time, you will need to ensure that you're paying general prevailing wage or hourly wages that complies with the PWA Act in Illinois. You must provide documentation and verification to the IPA under the contract. So the report, the first report is due 5 business days of the date of first operation. In general, throughout the term of the term where there's applicable work being done, you must provide this verification to the IPA each year and no later than July 15, following the close of a delivery year when work is done. The Prevailing Wage Act requirements applies also to projects that are outside of Illinois. And what we are looking for here is wage parity. And you can use the published prevailing wage if available, or the federal Davis-Bacon rates to comply with the IPA's, the Illinois PWA's requirement. And then we also have the project labor requirements. The labor requirements is basically something that has to be filed with the IPA. The project labor agreement has to be filed with the IPA within 30 days of the execution of the PLA or when there is an amendment within 30 days of that. And if the project is not yet energized and you are still negotiating or have recently finalized your project labor agreement, you need to provide this 60 days prior to the start of the project's construction. This is to be delivered to the director of the IPA. More information on these requirements, the PWA and the PLA, can be found in section 6.3 and 6.2 of the contract. There is also the MES requirement, what we call the minimum equity standard requirements. As Mr. Anthony Starr had mentioned earlier, there is a portal that has been set up and released publicly. You can find more information on how to comply with the MES requirements and equity standards on that website as well. This MES requirements is applicable to projects where the date of first operation of the project has not occurred prior to December 15 of 2022. This MES, what we call the minimum equity standard, is just a minimum. It applies generally to all of the projects. It is fixed at 10% throughout the life of the contract. So it's not a moving target. It doesn't change. And it is applicable to the delivery years in which construction activities are performed. And it will end, the requirement will end at the point of the date of first operation. And in the contract, you'll find these three requirements There's a forward-looking compliance plan that is generally due at the beginning of the delivery year, and you have a mid-year confirmation to tell the IPA that you are on track to meet the equity standards from your plan. And then once the year is over, you will provide to the IPA a year-end MES report. This is due by July 15 after the year that has concluded. If you're a seller that is an EEC, equitable eligible contractor, then you are deemed to have met the 10% MES and not subject to the MES reporting requirements. And then as a reminder, there is the optional provision under the RFP. If construction activities have not yet begun as of the part one proposal, you may choose to commit to a higher equity level greater than 10%. You can find out more information about this to get a bid strike price reduction under the bid evaluation ranking in the RFP rules itself. And the last reporting requirement is important for us to know how to calculate the REC price so that you can settle with buyer. So what is required of you is within 5 days after the vintage month when the electricity has generated to provide to the IPA and buyer a monthly generation report that will provide the hourly real-time LMP. This is for the applicable hub, but also the generation data from your project's P-note. This has to be provided to both buyer and the IPA. You will also be required to provide a read-only access to the buyer and IPA so they can verify the information in either the PJM power markets system, power meter system, sorry, or the MISO market portal. So that we can account for the generation correctly and get the price right, we are encouraging you to inform the IPA as soon as you can once the date of first operation has occurred under GETS or MRETS, once you have energized the project and registered the project with GETS or MRETS. And with that, I will now turn the time over to Ms. Katie Olandi to walk us through the rest of this presentation. Ms. Olandi?
Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm gonna start off this next presentation with the schedule for the RFP process, and then we'll talk about how to register for an account so that you can submit a proposal to qualify a project to bid. This section will also go through the details of the qualification requirements and process, and then a final section on bid submission and evaluation. So the RFP process actually kicks off tomorrow with the opening of the part one window, and then it's going to proceed over the next 2 months. As Ben mentioned, the qualification process is in two parts, and the first part is the part one proposal when you'll submit your qualification materials. Those materials are due by the part one date, which is Thursday, May 18th. That's when you'll pay the bid participation fee of $500 to the IPA. At that time, applicants are given time to cure any deficiencies and to respond to requests for additional information or clarification from us. And then by June 1, that's the part one notification date, applicants are informed whether they've qualified to submit a part two. The part two includes posting bid assurance collateral with each company, ComEd, Ameren, and MidAmerican, in the form of cash or a letter of credit. That window will open on Friday, June 2nd, and close on the part two date on Thursday, June 15th. Applicants that have a successful part two proposal can then submit their bids on the bid date, which is the following Friday, June 23rd. We'll hold a training session on June 20th so that qualified bidders can ask any questions they have about the bid form, can practice using the secure bid transfer, really walk through all of the procedures that would be used on that Friday. And then bids selected on the bid date are subject to approval by the ICC. So the ICC is expected to release its decision on the results of the RFP on Thursday, June 29th. So in order to submit a bid for a project in the RFP, you're going to first submit your proposal via online proposal forms. To register for an account to access the online proposal forms, you'll visit the procurement website, ipa-energyrfp.com, and then fill out the qualification registration under the Contact Us page. You should select to indicate that you're going to be participating in indexed wind, solar, and brownfield. And then what is very important is that you provide us the number of projects for which you intend to submit a proposal. So a separate proposal has to be submitted for each project. So you're going to be provided access to multiple online proposal forms through a single account. You'll also provide your name, company name, email, and phone number. Alternatively, you could email us this information to illinois-rfp@nera.com. So I would say anyone on this call that does plan to participate, even if you're not sure yet, you can go ahead and request accounts as soon as possible. Then you can gain access and have a look around the forum ahead of time to prepare your materials. We're going to issue one account per company, and the information to activate the account is sent to the individual that registers for the account. This individual will receive an email with instructions as shown in the screenshot below. You'll also get a guide with screenshots for account activation and for completing the forms and instructions for paying the bid participation fee. We'll issue accounts within 24 hours of receipt of your registration. And we'll begin issuing accounts tomorrow. Once you have an account, you can access the online forms in two ways. You can go directly to this web address here, or you can access through the procurement website by clicking on the qualification form subpage under the indexed wind, solar, and brownfield section of the website. You can see that here in this screenshot. So this next section, I'm going to walk through the details of the qualification requirements and the process. This slide provides some general information before we dive into specific requirements of the Part 1 proposal. For purposes of your proposal, the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that signs the index rec contract if the project is selected. If there are multiple projects and sellers, then these entities do not need to be the same. And I'll discuss this further on the next slide. A Part 1 proposal consists of information submitted through the online form, supporting documents that are uploaded, and then inserts that are also uploaded. So inserts are documents that we provide to you in Word format. They'll need to be filled in and in some cases signed by an authorized individual. And these inserts are already posted to the procurement website, and they're grouped by category of project, either wind, solar, or brownfield. So as you prepare for your proposal, please do download the appropriate zip file for your project. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the index rec contract. The bidder is the entity that's submitting the proposal. So this slide provides some examples for naming these entities. If you're presenting a single project, then the bidder and the seller must be the same entity. That's box one. If you're presenting multiple projects with multiple sellers, there are a couple examples here for naming the bidder. You could use the parent entity as the bidder, as shown in the bottom box three. Alternatively, you could identify the bidder as a list of the seller names separated by a comma. Now, once you begin filling in the online proposal form, you'll be asked for some basic information. This includes a name for the project and to provide contact information for entities and authorized individuals that are applicable to the project. You'll give us the exact legal name of the entity, the seller and the bidder, and the address. You'll name and provide contact information for an officer of the seller. This is an individual who can make all representations required in Part 1 and Part 2 and is expected to sign the contract. This individual must be empowered to bind the seller. You'll also provide contact information for up to 4 representatives. These are the individuals that are authorized to act on behalf of the bidder and seller, and they're the people we'll be in contact with if we have questions about the proposal materials. They'll be responsible for responding to requests for additional information. And if you're submitting multiple projects, then all representatives must be the same across your proposals. Lastly, in section 1, if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, this is a business that is majority owned by equity eligible persons, or a nonprofit or cooperative that is majority owned by EEPs, or is a natural person that is an EEP offering personal services as an independent contractor, then you'd indicate that here in section 1 of the form, and you'll provide documented evidence of that. So specifically, you'll give information about the business structure of the seller and identify these EEPs. And then for each equity eligible person, you'll provide evidence of their qualified status. In the Part 1 proposal, you'll also provide basic information about the project. So the category, the system size, and the first date of operation, either actual or expected. Again, projects that started operations prior to June 1, 2017 are not eligible. You can submit evidence to support a higher capacity factor than 45% for utility scale wind or 30% for utility scale solar or brownfield. These capacity factors on this slide are used as an input to calculate the maximum annual quantity of RECs that you can submit as part of your bid. If you'd like to bid a higher capacity factor, then you'd be required to submit something like a forecast of energy production and relevant design specifications that support this higher capacity factor. There are requirements for some projects related to project labor agreements. If construction activities for the project began prior to September 15th, 2021, this requirement does not apply to the project. If construction activities have begun as of the submission of the Part 1, but did not begin prior to September 15, 2021, then the bidder must provide evidence that the project labor agreements for the projects have been filed with the director of the IPA. If construction activities have not begun as of the submission of the Part 1, then the seller will be required to certify that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. You'll also be asked to acknowledge the requirements under the contract and the terms and conditions as defined by the Project Labor Agreements Act. If construction activities have begun for the project and they started on or after September 15th, please do not delay in submitting your project labor agreements to the IPA using the email address on this slide. Evidence that the IPA has determined that the PLA that you submit to them meets the requirements will be due with the Part 2 proposal. So in the Part 1 proposal, unless a project was operational prior to December 15th, 2022, or the seller is an equity eligible contractor, then the officer of the seller is going to be required to acknowledge that the minimum equity standard of 10% will apply to the project and that there are reporting requirements under the contract. Also in this section, on an entirely optional basis, if construction activities for the project have not begun as of the submission for Part 1, the seller can commit to a higher equity level percentage than 10% in order to qualify for that bid evaluation price reduction that Ben was describing. In order to qualify for that, you'll have to submit the additional documentation listed on this slide. A certification that acknowledges the additional reporting requirements under the contract and penalties should the seller fail to demonstrate that higher equity level is met. A narrative plan that describes how the seller will meet the higher commitment, including a communication plan for outreach and a projection of the total number of workers related to construction activities up to the point of first operation that you expect to be as part of the workforce. You'll also provide letters of intent to negotiate or contract with contractors or subcontractors that employ equity eligible persons, or evidence of current employment of EEPs for 50% times the higher equity level that you're committing to times that projected number of workers from the narrative plan. So required information regarding the project site is going to differ between utility scale wind and solar versus brownfield projects. So this slide covers the requirements applicable to utility scale projects. You'll need to provide the complete address along with a map that clearly shows the location of the project. If your project is located in a state adjacent to Illinois, and you wish to qualify on the basis of the public interest criteria in the Act, you must be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. And you'll submit the evidence of pre-approval as part of your Part 1. So currently on the IPA's website, there's an evaluation spreadsheet that you can download by clicking the link on this slide. You'll submit it to the IPA for approval. And then they'll issue you a document that states that your project has been pre-approved, and you'll upload that to your form. Also, applicants will confirm whether the project site is located entirely within an energy transition community grant area. And if it is, you'll need to put the boundary of the energy transition community grant area on the project map submitted with the proposal. This map that you submit with your Part 1 is going to become an exhibit to the contract. So this slide and then the next three are going to pertain to qualifying a brownfield site project. Brownfield projects must be located in Illinois. Again, you'll provide the complete address along with a map of the project site, and we'll be looking to ensure that the project is entirely contained within the brownfield site. You'll be asked to confirm whether the project is co-located with another facility on a greenfield site, which is acceptable. But in that case, we just note that the project contained within the brownfield site must have a single dedicated meter and its own account registered in GATS or MRETS. The project site must fit into one of the two buckets here from the definition under the Act. It's either regulated by the US EPA or Illinois EPA under one of the four programs that I'm going to list on the next slide, or is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues, and then meets the requirements of this full second definition here. This slide provides the four programs under which a brownfield site qualifying under the first bucket must be regulated. The table provides the applicable program on the left. And then on the right, we provide a list of sufficient documentation that can be provided as evidence that the project is regulated by that program. And we will accept other documents that you think demonstrates regulation under the program. You'll submit those as well, but here we've listed ones that have been essentially pre-approved, although still subject to evaluation. Any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier than 25 years prior to the bid date. And there are additional requirements for projects that are regulated by the IEPA Site Remediation Program. And those additional requirements pertain to demonstrating actual blight or contamination at the project site. And they're fully described in paragraph 4.5.5 of the RFP rules. For a project located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, the bidder will certify that they meet the requirements of the definition from the Act. And then to demonstrate that the project site meets the definition, we'll be looking for a copy of the permit for coal mining operation, including the reclamation plan, a copy of approval of the permit, and then document and confirmation that the reclamation has been completed and the entirety of the performance bond for the site has been released. With this slide, we're back to discussing eligibility requirements applicable to all three categories. So in the part one, in section six of the form, projects are required to meet a project maturity requirement. This can be accomplished by providing the documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or a utility, or by demonstrating site control for a portion of the project site. So if you can provide a document from this table or a later study through the interconnection process, then you don't need to provide any evidence of site control. If you haven't started the interconnection process, that's no problem. Your project can still qualify if you can show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the project site. So to figure out how much site control is required, if you are going to go that route, you need to demonstrate site control for at least 40 acres times the project size for a utility scale wind project, at least 4 acres times the project size for utility scale solar, and 3 acres times the project size for brownfield. And this table here provides a list of some of the acceptable documentation you can submit. And there are many, many types that we will accept. And they can be different depending, across your different landowners. Also, if a document that you provide is a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, then there's a list of specific minimum requirements posted as Appendix 4 to the RFP rules. The seller is going to make a number of certifications regarding the project. Examples are that there will be a single revenue quality meter, there's no substitution for another project, and that a project is not a repowered facility. In regards to the seller, the officer will be required to accept the terms of the index rec contract and acknowledge the collateral requirements that are required to be posted. Also, the seller must certify that seller, including its contractors and subcontractors, rendering services under the index rec contract, will apply with all requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act. And projects that are not located in Illinois must demonstrate at minimum wage parity with the prevailing wage requirements in Illinois. If the seller or its guarantor is rated by one or more of the major ratings, then please provide credit ratings in part one. This information is going to be used for a credit assessment under the contract. But it's not a requirement for the seller to be rated, and nor is it a requirement to have a rated guarantor in order to participate in the RFP. Also, as Ben mentioned, and I mentioned earlier with the calendar, you'll pay a $500 bid participation fee to the IPA if you haven't participated in a prior event in 2023. If you plan to use a letter of credit to post financial guarantees under the contract, should you be a winner, then it's a good idea to begin working with your financial institution already at this time. You can download the two options for the post-bid letter of credit that's provided as exhibits to the contract. And then you can, if necessary, submit red lines with any mocked up edits requested by your bank for review by the companies. You'd submit these red lines to us by email or upload to the form. Right now, there are already preliminary lists of modifications that are deemed acceptable by all of the companies. They're posted to the procurement website, and you can send the template along with that list to your bank. You can also submit any comments or proposed modification to the pre-bid letters of credit for each company. The pre-bid letter of credit is an option to be used to meet the bid assurance collateral due with part two. You can also use cash. There are two versions of the template pre-bid letter of credit for a company, and they have different terms. The electronic version will accommodate transmission by the issuing bank by electronic means. And the second version would accommodate transmission by the issuing bank via overnight delivery service. So depending on what your bank procedures are, you'll use one of these two versions. They're posted to the website in separate zip files. And again, there are preliminary lists of modifications that have already been deemed acceptable to each company to these templates. So once you've completed the form for your project and you're ready to submit for us to review, you're going to click submit on the form, and then we will evaluate promptly. And while we evaluate your proposal, you will be temporarily locked out of your account. We'll provide a notice back to you as soon as the evaluation is complete. It'll be either a complete or a deficiency notice. And if you receive a deficiency notice, you will be given a list of clarifications or additional items needed and a further deadline. Typically, you're given to the part one date or an additional 2 business days, whichever is later to respond. The part one date, again, when your proposal is due, is May 18th. And then the part one notification, when you're informed whether you can submit a part two, is June 1. The components of the part one notification are listed here. If you qualify, you'll receive a letter notifying you of your qualified status. This is when we'll provide to you a customized bid form that'll be used to submit bids for all of your qualified projects. You'll receive instructions for completing and submitting the bid form, an invitation to the training session, confidential credentials for submitting the bid form via an online secure bid transfer system, and then detailed instructions for providing bid assurance collateral to each of the companies. If your project's qualified, then you'll start submitting your part two materials the following day. And the deadline is June 15th. And you must meet the first 3 bullets here by that deadline. So you'll complete the online form, you'll email additional certifications, and you'll submit the bid assurance collateral to each of the companies. The bids are part of the part two proposal, but they are not due until June 23rd, the bid date. So specifically, some of the requirements of the online form include electing the form of bid assurance. So will you be submitting cash or letters of credit? If cash is submitted, then the bidder will acknowledge the conditions under which cash can be drawn. If you're using letters of credit, then we'll ask you, are you sending them electronically or by overnight delivery service? If applicable, the bidder will be required to submit evidence that the IPA has determined the project labor agreements submitted for the project meet the requirements. And also you'll provide an indicative quantity for the project. That's an annual number of recs that you plan to bid, and it's non-binding at the part two point. So this slide provides the required bid assurance collateral amounts. Bid assurance collateral is a function of the size of the project. And an example for how to calculate the bid assurance collateral for a wind project is provided here at the bottom of the slide. So a 200 megawatt wind project will submit $320,000 to Ameren. That's 1600 times 200, 800,000 to ComEd, and 80,000 to MidAmerican. If you present proposals for multiple projects, you can submit a single pre-bid letter of credit or affect a single wire transfer to each company in the amount that's required across all of your projects. This slide provides some additional requirements related to bid assurance collateral. So if you're submitting cash, you'll need to provide the W-9 for the entity that posted. And for which you wish the cash to be returned. You'll provide a draft request for the return of cash, and we post samples of such requests to the procurement website. You'll also submit a certification acknowledging the conditions under which cash can be drawn. If you're submitting the pre-bid letter of credit for a company, your bank again uses the electronic version or the hard copy version. They'll be submitted to the companies. And if you use a hard copy version, it's highly recommended that the bank also send a PDF version That would be coming electronically, and also a tracking number so that the companies can track the package. Again, the letters of credit must be in the standard forms posted as appendices. The electronic versions are appendices 5 to 7. The hard copy version are appendices 8 to 10 to the rules, and they're posted on the final materials page. And again, we'll send detailed instructions for submission with part one notification. And lastly, I wanted to highlight one more time that cash that is posted as bid assurance collateral under the RFP can be used to meet performance assurance requirement under the contract should the project have a winning bid. So that concludes the overview of the qualification process. I have a final section here that provides some protocols for submitting bids and then the steps of the post-bid process. So a customized bid form that we're going to provide to each bidder is the exclusive method for submitting bids. Bid forms are submitted to us through a secure bid transfer site on the bid date on June 23rd during a bid window from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon. If the bid form isn't completely filled out or is inconsistent with the rules, then it won't be evaluated on the bid date. And so we have a cure deficiency period of an hour. If we receive your bid form and there's a deficiency, we'll get in touch with you during that cure period. That way you can remedy any issue before the window closes. We're going to provide bidders with a step-by-step guide if you have a qualified project with your part one notification. And then again, you have a chance to practice all of the procedures on June 20th. So your bid will have three core elements. You'll provide your strike price for the project in dollar per megawatt hour. You'll provide a full quantity that represents the annual quantity of RECs the seller is offering to deliver. And then you provide the minimum quantity, and that represents the minimum annual quantity of RECs that the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. A project would receive potentially a partial award, so less than the full quantity, but never below the minimum quantity, if the project is the marginal project selected during bid evaluation. And the marginal project, again, is the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target. So in the table in this slide, in the dark purple cells, this hypothetical 100 megawatt wind project is bidding to deliver an annual quantity of 300,000 RECs. The bidder inputted a minimum quantity that is less than the full quantity. So the bidder's indicating that it would accept a partial award of no less than 500,000 RECs at the strike price of $100 per megawatt hour. So this means if during the evaluation procedure, it's not possible to select at least 250,000 RECs, the project will not be selected. Also, very importantly, in your bid form, that's where you'll select an index hub, either MISO Illinois hub or PJM Northern Illinois hub that corresponds to the bid for the project. This hub's used for purposes of payment, and you can select either hub, irregardless of where the project's located. The bid evaluation, again, will proceed independently for each category. First, bids that fail to meet or beat the benchmark are eliminated. Next, the lowest strike price submitted for each category is identified, and it's used to adjust the strike price submitted for projects that either one committed to an equity level for the project greater than 10% MES, and or is a utility scale wind or solar project that's located entirely within an energy transition community grant area. So once those strike prices are adjusted down, the bids are ranked lowest to highest, incorporating those adjusted strike prices. And then in order of strike price, the full quantities of projects, starting with the lowest strike prices, are selected until either all projects are selected or until selecting the project with the next highest strike price would exceed the target. At that time, if the remaining target's less than the minimum quantity for this marginal project, then the marginal project is selected at the minimum quantity, as long as this would result in exceeding the target for the category by no more than an additional 50% of the target. And this possibility to exceed the target by up to an additional 50% when selecting the marginal project is new for this procurement event. If the target would be exceeded by more than 50%, then the project won't be selected and the target for the category will remain unfilled. There's an appendix 15 to the RFP rules that's posted. It provides a detailed example of the strike price adjustment and this evaluation process. On the bid date, we expect to notify bidders by 6 p.m. whether they have projects with a bid that will be identified as a winning bid to the ICC. At that time, if you haven't already provided to prepare the contract with your proposal, that information will be submitted to us by email, and we will pass that to the companies. And then within 2 business days of the bid date, the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor will each submit a confidential report to the ICC. And then within 2 business days of receipt of the reports, the ICC will decide whether to accept the results. Once the commission renders its decision, each company will send partially executed contract documents to the seller. The seller countersigns and sends them back and fulfills the creditworthiness requirements. And we'll send detailed instructions ahead of this time regarding these execution procedures. The collateral requirement under the Index Rec contract is due within 8 business days of approval of the results. Also, payment of the supplier fees to the IPA is due within 7 business days of approval of the results by the commission. Bid assurance collateral could be drawn upon if supplier fees are not paid within 7 days of approval. And we received a question regarding when bid assurance collateral is returned. So cash posted in the part 2 is returned if the project is not selected or chooses not to bid. So if you submit a part 2 proposal, you post cash, but you don't bid, your cash is returned. An LC for such a project that chooses not to bid or does not have a winning bid will simply expire on the date in the template, which is 14 days after ICC decision. If you bid and win, the collateral is returned once you sign the contract, pay the supplier fee, and post performance assurance collateral. If you use cash, you can use that cash towards the performance assurance. If there's a difference, you can post that difference, or you'll receive a difference back. If you use a post-bid LC, that's an entirely separate document to post before your bid assurance collateral is returned. So I hope that answers the question. And that takes us to the end of the presentation portion. Please do go ahead and submit any additional questions to us by clicking on the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. We'll go ahead and take a break here while we receive questions.